and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
In our current political climate, when our country and Russia seem very distrustful of one another, we're bringing you a show about a time when Alaskans and Russians were reunited and found they shared a common heritage. We're going to hear incredible tales from key players in melting the Alaska-Russia ice curtain during the mid-1980s, discuss how Alaska helped end the Cold War, launching a 30-year era of productive commercial and personal relations across the Bering Strait. This event was sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council and took place at 49th State Brewing Company on December 1st. We go now to Lisa Falsko, President and CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, with today's introduction.
We are pleased to have one of our very own who organized and moderating today's program, Mr. David Ramser, who is this year's chair of the Alaska World Affairs Council Board of Directors and the author of a new book entitled Melting the Ice Curtain, The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russia-Alaskan Frontier. He published the book in the summer by University of Alaska Press, and it's a dramatic story of how inspiration, courage, and persistence by Alaskan and Russian citizen diplomats stared down the Cold War to bridge a widening gap in superpower relations, a model sorely needed today. I'm glad I took my copy when I was in Norway a couple weeks ago. It's really fascinating, it's funny, it's informative, and it's about an important area in current Alaska history. I love telling the story aspects of the book, and today we are going to be able to see the book come alive in this panel. For this program, David has assembled some of the key players in melting the ice curtain who will talk about their experience. A nearly 40-year Alaskan, David is a former newspaper reporter who served as a top aide to Alaska Governors Steve Cooper and Tony Knowles, and to Anchorage Mayor and U.S. Senator Mark Begich. He has visited the Soviet Union and Russia more than a dozen times, lived and worked in Russia, and has published numerous articles about Russia. David is a visiting scholar in public policy at UAA's Institute of Social and Economic Research, an avid golfer, and an impressive runner and triathlete. I'd like to hand over the microphone to Mr. David Ramser.
Thanks much, Lisa, for that introduction, and thanks to everyone for being here. Thanks also for the excuse to allow me to wear my Beatles Back in the USSR tie, which I don't get a chance to very often. Really appreciate the opportunity to focus on an important era in not only Alaska's history, but I would argue an important era in U.S. history, the melting of the Alaska-Russia ice curtain. And thanks to the efforts of those on our panel today, along with thousands of other Alaskans and Russians, we helped in the Cold War and showed how average citizens can bridge a widening gap in superpower relations. And I believe that is a model that's needed today as relations between Washington and Moscow dangerously deteriorate. Let's start the program today with a quick scene setter before I introduce our panel. Since the time of the Bering Land Bridge, about 30,000 years ago, the indigenous people of this region freely crossed the 55 miles between mainland Alaska and Russia for subsistence hunting and fishing and to share a similar culture. And the two countries cooperated during World War II as the U.S. supplied nearly 8,000 warplanes across the Bering Strait to help Russia fight Germany. But just 3 years after World War II, Cold War paranoia overcame all that goodwill, and several events soured relations across the strait, so the U.S. and Soviet governments decided that national security interests outweighed those of Alaska Natives. So in 1948, the two countries erected what we call an ice curtain, similar to the Iron Curtain in Germany. It sealed the border and banned all contact, and this would last for 40 years. The result was forcefully separating families who for centuries traveled freely to visit each other. Fast forward about four decades when pressure started to build to end this isolation in the Bering Strait. And I think it was a result of three main factors. First, the memories of long separated native peoples were starting to fade. These native elders were getting quite old, and they wanted one last opportunity for reunification before passing from the scene. And second, a progressive Soviet leader came to power in the form of Mikhail Gorbachev. And he encouraged interactions with the West, which portrayed him to the world as a new type of reformist Soviet leader. And third, Alaska business and civic leaders started to detect an opening for interaction across the Bering Sea after 40 years. And what followed were a series of headline-grabbing initiatives by hundreds of Alaskan and Russian citizen diplomats to pressure their national governments to open the strait. And each of our panelists today played key roles in helping melt the ice curtain. So Nome realtor Jim Stemfel here across from me was inspired by the family of his wife, Bernadette Alvana, to help reunite long separated Native peoples. And after his efforts to motivate Alaska politicians fell largely on deaf ears, Jim launched what he called balloon diplomacy and many other efforts, including the pioneering 1988 Alaska Airlines friendship flight between Nome and Providinia. Jim helped arrange for nearly three dozen Alaska Native elders to reunite with their distant Russian relations in Providinia that day. Our next panelist is Dave Heatwall, who was an ARCO executive who caught the Russian bug working to establish business ties through the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. Through more than 50 trips to the Soviet Union and Russia, Dave was one of the rare Alaskans who successfully engaged in business with Russia, selling everything from gold mining equipment to American hot dogs in Magadan. And Dave survived the infamous ruble crash in 1998, shakedowns by border guards, and too many vodka toasts to count. And Dave's biggest accomplishment was courting his future wife in Russia. And our third panelist is Elena Farkas, who grew up in Magadan and first interacted with Alaskans on a 1988 teacher exchange. She accompanied her Russian students to Alaska 3 years later and then permanently moved to Anchorage, where she ran a Russian bookstore for many years. And Elena helped develop Alaska's Russian language immersion program. And last year, her first contingent of Alaska students who began their Alaska studies in first grade graduated from high school, and she continues to play a key role in keeping Russian culture alive in Alaska. So let's begin our discussion by finding out what motivated each of our panelists to get involved in this potentially dangerous, but certainly crazy notion of melting the Alaska-Russia ice curtain. And Jim, I think I'll start with you on that.
Well, David Ramser was, at the time I met David, he was Governor Cooper's press secretary and some of the other cabinet members. But I remember David because they would not let me see Governor Cooper. They weren't sure if I was a crackpot or just some nutty guy from Nome launching balloons across the Bering Strait with sugar, tea, coffee, messages written in Siberian Yupik in Russian. And at the time, I had no idea that it would end up today at this table. But it was a crazy time because Gorbachev, Reagan, and Thatcher. I'm thinking of another Maggie in Nome, Alaska, anyway. When Thatcher told Reagan that, you know, we got to get to know Gorbachev, he's got all these great ideas. And all I remember from Reagan was the evil empire. And, you know, living in Nome, it was right across from the evil empire. But I listened to the Eskimo people in my wife's family and the talk that they used to go back and forth all the time to trade and to look for wives. So I just thought to myself, well, let's try to do this again. So that's how it began. And I guess I didn't realize I needed to register as a foreign agent. So I guess it's not too late. But anyway, I'm glad to see all of you in the room and be happy to talk more.
Dave, talk a bit about how you got inspired to get involved here.
My inspiration came when Alaska flew the second Freedom to Break the Ice Curtain to Nadir. On March 1st, left here, but actually in Russia, it was March 2nd, 1989. We landed on the Nadir airstrip, and I saw these MiG fighters and Bear bombers as we taxied in. And we got there in this cold, swept Nadir, which is like landing in Kotzebue, and here was this bunch of people, several hundred all bundled up, waiting to see the first Americans that had been there since land lease, which David just talked about. And they were such a nice people, and they treated us wonderfully. We had the typical Russian lunch with plenty of vodka and everything. And I keep a daily diary, and my diary, which I read just yesterday to refresh my mind, I wrote in there, the Russian people are just like us. They have a European descent, they're Judeo-Christian values, and they really want to have a relation with the United States. And so at the time, the communism was ending and market economy was coming. The top-down economy was becoming a bottom-up economy. And I said to myself, this is the best business time in my lifetime. This change is happening. I got a chance to come in here and really do something. I drug ARCO over there, kicking and screaming. They created a new company for me to go over there, and we were well on our way to getting leases for oil, and then they decided we don't want to be the first company to do, U.S. company to do oil exploration in Russia, so they canceled my project, and I said, okay, I'm going to do this myself. And I quit 27 years of working for a Fortune 500 company and started out on my own. And you can read what happened in David's book. I wound up selling a lot of everything, from spare parts to bulldozers, to hot dogs. We pioneered ice cream in. We did a lot of things, and it worked very well for me. But the main thing was the Russian people and how much they wanted to be with us and how much we wanted to be with them. That's what drove me. So.
Okay, Elena, tell us about your first interactions with Americans and what your interest in Alaska was.
Okay, let me bring some Russian flavor. We'll start speaking Russian because it's a melting curtain. Just a couple of words. Добрый день. Меня зовут Елена Фаркас. Я очень рада всех вас здесь видеть. Good afternoon. My name is Елена Фаркас, and I'm very happy to see all of you here. My interaction started back in 1988 when I physically met the first Americans. But I think my first interaction with America started through the American culture and American literature. I'm very grateful to three people who came to Magadan back then in 1988. They were Betsy Leonard, Larry Rockhill, and Rick Mattia. They were three people who brought the gift of knowledge to our students. They came to my school, and I taught in school number one, because we started kind of exchange letter back and forth between one of the schools in Soldatna and the school in Magadan. And when these three Americans arrived with dozens and dozens of different boxes of gifts for our students and told us how happy they are to see us, how happy they are to share, and how they were studying Russian in correspondence school, they were trying to teach Russian to students because Russia was so close, and they felt that this is where the Russian, where the people diplomacy should start. And the enthusiasm of those people, they believe in future relationship between the countries, that was a great motivation for me.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing tales from key players in melting the Alaska-Russia ice curtain in the mid-1980s. Let's go back to the stage to David Ramser, who is chair of the board of directors of the Alaska World Affairs Council and was our moderator for this event.
Jim, I think the Alaska Airlines Friendship Flight was one of the sort of groundbreaking events that happened during this period, and you were certainly very instrumental in putting that together and putting more than 30 Alaska Natives on that flight. Can you describe a bit how that came together and what your reaction was and the reaction of those, particularly the Native families on the flight when they landed in Providencia?
Well, at that time, Alaska Airlines had an advisory board, and they were going to meet in Nome, and Wiley Scott, I talked to him. He was on the advisory board. He said, I'd like to talk to Alaska Airlines about flying to Russia. And so he got me to go to the board meeting. And so I pitched it, and then Jim Johnson with Alaska Airlines said, Jim, we'll call you. So as I left the meeting, I said, daggone it, I bombed. They're not going to do nothing. So I walked across the street to the Nugget newspaper, and a guy named Ken Wells from the Wall Street Journal happened to be in Nome. And Ken said, pitch me the story, Jim. So I pitched him the story, and 2 weeks later, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, Alaska Airlines to fly to Russia. Of the Soviet Union. So Jim Johnson calls me from Seattle and says, hey, Jim, we didn't agree to do this. But Bruce Kennedy was the CEO at the time, and he said, we're going to do it. And so that started the whole mechanism of allowing me to see the governor of Alaska. The State Department started to respond, but that private sector involvement made a big difference to get the border opened.
And describe what it was like landing in Providencia. 40 years had gone by when many of these Native families had not seen relatives on the other side. What was it like to land?
Yeah, you know, when you take off in a jet from Nome, you either head to Kotzebue or you head to Anchorage. But for the first time, that Alaska Airlines jet headed straight across the Bering Strait. And within 20 minutes, we were landing in Providencia. And the plane was filled pretty much 30-30-30, press people, dignitaries, and Native people. And we were sitting in the back of the bus, so to speak, and the press gets off first, and then the dignitaries get out, and there's a red carpet. And me and Tim Galargan got out of the back of the bus, or the back of the jet, and we looked over and we saw this crowd of young kids and Native people. And so I said to Tim, hey, Tim, let's go over there and see those people. And so we broke rank and walked over to the rope that contained everyone. And we started trying to, I only knew two words of Russian, hello and goodbye. and Tim spoke Siberian Yupik. And this was a moment when, for the first time in 40 years, a woman named Margarita Gluklich-Siganova looked at Tim and spoke Siberian Yupik, and Tim answered back. And they asked about their relatives. And so when the press saw what was going on, they left the dignitaries and came right to us. And so it was helter-skelter, it was chaos. And the rope came down, and people started hugging each other. And I remember Mayor Kulinkin came over with his translator, Michael Kozakiewicz, who spoke really good English. And he said, hey, Jim, we got to get everybody on these buses. But we have which bus for which bus? Native people on one bus, dignitaries, blah, blah, blah. And I said, Mike, you're not going to get these people to separate ever again. And so we just got on any bus we wanted. And from that moment on, the next 12 hours was just a wonderful event to happen to see each other after 40 years.
Thanks for that. Dave, talk a little bit about your early business experience. What barriers were there to working in Russia? I remember In my early time going there, there was no credit card or banking system. People who wanted to work in Russia, we would strap $10,000 in cash to our bodies to go over, which was always pretty disconcerting. What were your experiences like?
Well, one of the first things was how to get foreign goods, U.S.-made goods, into Russia. There were two ways to do it. You could use the mafia, which was very easily, or you could do it the hard way. Fortunately, I chose the hard way, which slowed things up a lot, but the mafia never got into my business at all because I didn't use them. But that was a choice you had to make, something that had to be done. Getting dollars back was always a problem, but of course, I was selling to gold miners, and the gold miners were allowed to have a certain amount of U.S. dollars. And so they would pay me in U.S. dollars. They actually had to trust me. They sent the cash to me. I bought the goods and sent it back to them. I remember when we got our first $1.7 million into the bank, I told my partner, let's go to Mexico, you know. But we didn't. We delivered the goods, and the more we delivered the goods, the more orders we got. And but the main thing was just how to get, and then when we got with cars, to get dollars, we had to go to the bank, and then you could go to the bank and change your rubles into dollars, and the dollars were sent back over here in that way.
So. And did you ever feel like you got shaken down by anybody on the Russian side? There were lots of rumors to that effect, that you had to kind of grease the palms to have business done.
I only, one time in Moscow, I got to the wrong airport. I went into the domestic terminal instead of the international. Those of you who've been there know they're just one side, but I was going to be late for my plane. I went out to get a taxi to go from the domestic over to the international side, and the taxi driver, some guy standing next to the taxi driver said, well, you have to give me $50. And the taxi driver says, I can't do it unless you pay me. That was the mafia. So I paid $50 to the mafia to take a $30 cap taxi so I could get on my plane. But that was the only bribe I had in everything I did. So I just didn't run into that kind of stuff because we kept our distance, and I had good Russian partners who did business in the right, correct way.
So, Elena, tell us, after your first interactions with Alaska, what inspired you to eventually move here?
What inspired me to move here? Okay, it was back to 1991. The first group of American business people, lawyers, singers, talented people came to Alaska. Came to Anchorage. I live in Anchorage for a long time. Anchorage began to be my home. Anchorage is the first instead of Magadan now. And it was the first delegation where I helped with interpreting, translating, and then doing some of the concert announcements, because it was the first visit to establish the connection between Magadan and Anchorage. It was the time when Magadan and Anchorage turned to be sister cities. And because of that, of those events, I went to United States. It was August of 1991, and we brought a group of kids who performed, who kind of did cultural exchange, because we received the cultural group and business people, and we went. And that time during one of the performances, I remember a man standing and looking for quite some time. And when I came back to Russia, a couple of months later, I received a letter. And a gentleman wrote to me that he would like to have my students from my school number one to do exchange, Ben Pell program, with students in Juneau. And we began writing back and forth. And when I came to United States in 1992, the second time, with the choir, we performed in different churches on the stage. I met that gentleman, and we fell in love. And this is how I stayed, okay? Because I got married. I'm not getting into details of that. But actually, I was involved not through the marriage, through the cultural exchanges. And that motivation to introduce the Russian culture, to, and it was interesting that the Russian culture was introduced not through adults. We brought the students who played different musical instruments. They showed dancing. They showed some of the circus performances. We've been everywhere. We've been in different churches. We've been on different radios. And people were so welcoming. People were coming and asking what we need to do to help you. How we can you get this package to some people in Magadan? It was very motivating. When I happened to stay in the United States, then I had to decide what my role will be in my new country. And because my daughter was born, and I was thinking, what will be my best contribution to the country through my knowledge, and my knowledge was teaching, I decided that with the help of Anchorage School District, we did the first attempt to start Russian immersion program back then in 1993, Bear Valley. It was mutual attempt from that time very, very tiny Russian community, from school district employees and motivated teachers, from parents. But at the time it didn't succeed because of different political climate, different view that people had, and we decided that we need to put real strong foundation in introducing the Russian culture, introducing and showing that Russian people, they are normal people. We do not have to be afraid of that ice curtain, whatever was told, whatever people maybe learned. It took us a while, but we were successful. It was a mutual effort that actually helped to melt that ice curtain.
So many Alaska families hosted Russians who came, and we put them up in our homes. And I remember taking Russians to Huffman Cars, to the vegetable section, and they would break down in tears because they had never seen such extravagance. Or to the shampoo section at an average Cars, and you know, there'd be 100 different varieties of shampoo. And Russians just couldn't believe it. Do you remember your first impressions? Was that the first time you had been to the United States when you came to Alaska?
Okay, the first time in 1991. It was very interesting that you remind me. I remember before we had performances in PAC on the Atwood Hall stage, because in Russia we had very limited resources. To go for a woman to get a pair of shoes or to do some kind of decent clothing, it was difficult. And I completely forgot about that. When I came here and I stayed and I realized there is a performance going, I do have shoes. I do have a dress that I made myself. I used to sew very nicely. I really miss it because I do not have time to do it. And you go to the store, you can buy everything. And my host family asked me, what would you like? What you would like from the store? I said, can you take me to the store where I can get a lipstick? Because I need to be on the stage. I need to be on the lipstick. And American journalist was following me all the time, taking pictures, asking different questions. And we ended up in JCPenney. That time, JCPenney back in 1992 was JCPenney. was JCPenney. Okay, and we went to that lipstick section, and I was putting all different lipstick because I need to fit to my outfit. You know, it's like women color coordinated things. I need to be seen from the stage for 2,000 people. Next day, I open the newspaper. And my host family comes, and I have a huge portrait of me putting the lipstick on my lips. Okay, that was a huge surprise. And the backstage of my mind was, oh my God, now what my delegation will say when I saw people who came with me, not the kids. The kids were okay, but the other people, they say, what is this? I said, what? What is this? And it's not about the culture. It's not about this. You are on the front page with lipstick on. I say, okay, let's read. And it was a huge article. It was so many different things. And it was nice things about our performance. Actually, that attracted so many people that the the pack was sold out. And then every time we were on the news, people will see us at the church, they will come and help. I mean, that was very, very unusual. I mean, this is the first time I was kind of
feeling a celebrity.
This is KSKA Anchorage. You are listening to Addressing Alaskans. Today, we are hearing from people who were instrumental in melting the Alaska-Russia ice curtain in the mid-1980s. Let's go back to David Ramser, longtime Alaska journalist and author of the book, Melting the Ice Curtain, The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russia-Alaska Frontier, as he moderates today's discussion.
So let me ask each of the panel members, you know, when all this started in the 80s, the Cold War was still definitely in place, and there was a lot of suspicion between our countries. Why do you think average Alaskans and Russians were successful in establishing these relationships in business and civic affairs and education? What was it that was magic about what happened in Alaska?
Well, I think it was the lipstick for sure. Yeah, there's so many stories that we had. I remember bringing over from Lee Wareham with Alascom a satellite receiver so people in Providence could watch The Price is Right so that they could understand prices. But at that time, citizen diplomacy was, I just remember from my civics class way back in Washington, D.C., where I grew up, that writing letters that one individual could make a difference. And so I began, and it just was like magic. It opened the border, and people were going back and forth, and so it was a wonderful time. And the Soviet Union roughly fell in 91 or 92, I can't, when Gorbachev got captured and everything. And then there was a big change, but still the people across the border, you know, we continued a large part because the national park system was refunded over and over again by Senator Stevens to do all these exchanges. And so that kept us going for 20 years with all these exchanges. So it was a wonderful time.
As you mentioned, earmarks from Senator Stevens, I've got this slide up here. One of the legacies of this era was creation of the American-Russian Center at UAA, which operated for about 15 years and received about $26 million in federal money, mostly earmarks from Senator Stevens. And that certainly kept the jets, the Alaska Airlines jets, full and kept a lot of Russians coming here and Alaskans going over there. Dave, what do you think, why did business work, at least for you? I know a number of Alaskans really got taken to the cleaners and lost their shirts in this era, but you were one of the few successful businessmen.
Well, I think the ice curtain melted because both sides wanted it to melt. We who were there wanted, the United States people that were going over there wanted to have good relations with the Russians, and the Russians I talked to wanted to have good relations with the U.S. You know, so it was a mutual thing going on both sides. And I think part of that was both of us are a long way from our central federal government. Think of Anchorage to Washington, D.C., and Magadan to Moscow. And a long distance between the federal influence. So we were less influenced by what's going on with federal policy. I think also we Alaskans have to realize that Alaska was part of Russia for a long time, and every Russian knows all about Alaska, so we were known to them when we went over there. Those are just a few things, I think, and of course we live in a similar climate-wise. We have some of the same problems about getting food up and importing food, so I think we were just the same kind of people, and we wanted to make it happen, and we made it happen.
And Elena, what are your impressions from the Russian perspective? Why was this era successful?
You know, when we go back and look at that time, I'm always thinking that, from my perspective, the melting and really warming relationships between Russia and United States started from Alaska. and it started from people diplomacy. It was amazing how Alaska and Russian people were involved. When first Americans came, they were very welcoming. And I think it was because not politicians came to Magadan, but business people, medical personnel, lawyers, teachers, and then students began coming. And through this interaction, people began seeing that we are the same. We do not have differences. We have so many things common. And those exchanges, I'm echoing both of you, those exchanges, they began building, melting, because it's kind of the drops of warmth. They were doing, and you do it more. It's kind of, and then when Magadan and Anchorage began to be sister cities, that even opened more curtain for us, because we brought our culture, we introduced the culture, but people were very welcoming. And it was not only the culture of contemporary, that time we will say the Soviet culture, it was the culture that already been introduced in the United States through Dostoevsky, through Tolstoy, through Tchaikovsky. Look, Tchaikovsky began to be like one of the favorite American composers. We cannot imagine our Thanksgiving without Nutcracker. Can you imagine? It was already in people. And this is what people were receiving. And the desire, I think it was even the time was right. It's kind of all things in combination. And then businesses got involved. I remember people who, like one name just came to my mind, Esther Petrie. She still works as the nurse in Providence Hospital. She would collect so many things and try to send, try to support the drive that people had. They, every corner they heard Russian people are coming or any kind of Russian performance, they will be there. They want to see, they wanted to interact, they wanted to come, they wanted to say just welcome, we're happy to see. You know, all of this were very welcoming for us. And when I came, when I stayed, I realized that what I can do, to contribute, what I can do to make our connections stronger. I realized one person, yes, the person can start making a difference, but that person cannot fully make a difference if that person will not get people together. And when I opened the business, one of the idea for the business was to introduce through business, to make business, not just business. Business never made any money. I mean, if you have that business like that, it will not make money. But the business was kind of center where a lot of American people were coming asking for help to translate or to explain something. Russian people who came here, they had kind of safe harbor, but at the same time, we did a lot of performances, we did a lot of kind of lecture, we did a lot of interactive, and what we did, we supported many businesses and educational entities. We supported University of Alaska, we supported the business center that was, we supported Archdiocese of Anchorage that was very influential in making connections with Magadan at that time. Archbishop Hurley was an amazing man who did put so many things together. We supported Anchorage School District. All of this foundation together made a difference.
So I think we're going to open it up for questions here in just a second. I wanted to ask Jim one specific question. Do you know what the status of relationships are across the strait between Native people? Is there much activity these days?
Yeah, there's still a lot of activity. My last trip over was in 2014, and the Native people of Alaska and Chukotka have been going back and forth, and through that National Park Service grant enabled, travel for many kids and many adults to continue. So it's been pretty good.
Okay. So Carrie, you have a question back there? Yep.
So I really want to thank all of the panelists for, that's really wonderful sharing these stories. So I want to very much thank you all. And especially just the effort that you made at personal diplomacy to really make this happen. Obviously, nowadays, given the tension that exists at the top, it's very difficult to do that. But the other thing that's kind of conditioning this is, even though Alaska is more or less the same, on the other side, it's a very different Russia. So especially David, you've been there comparatively recently. I'm wondering if you can talk about how it's changed, or at least your impressions of how it's changed since you first went over.
Boy, that's a... It's a long answer, but I'll try to make it very brief. During the Gorbachev and Yeltsin days, when all of us were going over there, Moscow extended authority to the regions to negotiate deals with the West. So if you were in Magadan and wanted to do a sister city relationship with Anchorage, for example, you had the approval and actually the encouragement from Moscow to do so. But when Putin came to power, he reined all that back to Moscow. And so now the regions do not have the authority to negotiate business deals or civic exchanges, sister city relationships, Rotary Club establishments, all the things that happened during this era. I was there last summer and went up the Bering Sea coast with eight other people in open boats. And for a minor paperwork violation, we were arrested by the border guards, detained for 16 hours, paraded in front of a federal judge, and each fined 500 rubles, which is $8 for our time. But I think it's an example of the petty harassment that goes on these days. And that's why a lot of Western companies are scared off, because it is so difficult to operate over there. I don't know, Dave, if you have a perspective on that, or Jim.
Well, I was wondering if Vic Fisher could say a few words to share with us, because he was a big part of my life later on.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I just want to support what the speakers have told us. This was a fascinating time, and Alaskans were excited to bring technical assistance, to bring democracy to our essentially friends across the Bering Strait. We, through the University of Alaska and independently, had a lot of ties, program, joint program efforts in science and research and education. And there was enthusiasm on both sides. And with Putin coming to power, you had the kind of a situation where Brian Rogers, who was a vice president of the University of Alaska, was a member of the board of trustees of the International University in Magadan, and so was I. And we were asked to resign from the board of trustees because Putin and the Russian Duma approved a law that essentially said that any Russian entity that receives money for partial funding from the U.S. or another Western nation has to declare itself to be an agent of a foreign power. And so a joint research center that we had established with the Russian Academy of Sciences had to split the US side. It was a US Russian research center. Essentially, it was a top-down decision that there will be no more collaboration. It's not all the way across the board, but there's a real dampening effect on the kind of enthusiasm that you had on both sides.
I think it's worth mentioning that Vic's relationship with Senator Stevens was largely responsible for bringing all this money to Alaska, which really helped melt the ice curtain. So I think Vic deserves a lot of the credit for all this.
You are tuned in to Addressing Alaskans here on Alaska Public Media. Today, we are learning about some of the people and events that helped Alaska melt the ice curtain between the United States and Russia. This event was sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council. We return to the program as the panelists answer questions from the audience.
Hi, my name is Megan Alvana Stimple. I'm Jim's oldest daughter, but I grew up during this era of peace, and I wanted to ask if I can ask you to tell a story, because it's my favorite story. I studied at George Mason University in Virginia, where my dad went to school, and I studied economics, and in my international trade class, I had to write a paper about a topic, you know, that no one's ever heard before to get an A. So I thought I'd write about the Nome Ruble Exchange. And my dad, as a president of the Nome Chamber of Commerce's Committee for Cooperation, Commerce, and Peace, which is a very official title, convinced all of Nome's businesses to accept rubles. And so, Dad, I was wondering how that went.
Well, it didn't go very well. I didn't know there was a Soviet law at the time that you could not take rubles out of the Soviet Union and you couldn't bring them back in again. So some of the businesses, we had collected rubles so that people visiting from Pravidenia, Nadir, Magadan could buy things in the stores from VCRs to whatever. It wasn't a one-to-one exchange. Each business decided maybe 5-to-1, 10-to-1, whatever. And so we started collecting rubles, and Jim Rowe with Bering Air was allowing people to come and pay in rubles to fly to Nome. And he had all his rubles over in Pravidenia. He had quite a bit, over 500,000 rubles. And so we figured out, well, what are we going to do with all these rubles? So we made a sign of the Russian hammer and sickle and the U.S. Stars and stripes shaking hands. And we had signs in the stores that say, we accept many rubles in Russian and English. And so when the tourists started to come to Nome, they wanted to buy rubles. So we sold, a one ruble note for $1. Three ruble note for $3. And so we started getting rid of the rubles. So that saved us. But it didn't create international border trade and starting businesses and stuff. But Jim Rowe got a message from his person in Pravidenia that the Soviet currency was going to change again and all the old rubles were going to be taken away. And so Jim quickly went over to Pravidenia, went to the bank, and gave all the rubles to the Pravidenia school.
Well, as I recall, Jim, you got a nasty gram from the Russian government saying, stop dispensing of all these Russian rubles. And what was your response?
Well, I got a letter from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Banking, and I can't remember his name now, but he said, you can't do this. And so, we just kept doing it because it was working.
I think your quote was, if Boris Yeltsin's going to stand on a tank in Moscow, we're going to take rubles in Nome.
Probably, yeah.
Other questions from the audience? Steve Heimel.
Steve Heimel, wow.
What a great program. Hey, I think somebody ought to bring up about the importance of the fact that the Soviet Union and the U.S. were allies in the Second World War, and that Alaska was the corridor for delivering all those airplanes when the U.S. couldn't get in the war yet, and that was very fondly remembered when Americans started getting over there.
We did mention that at the beginning, but Dave, you had a lot of interaction with Russian military. Can you tell us maybe your submarine story?
I'll tell you one story. Yes, you can hear me there. Get right up. There, we got it. Anyway, in November of 1992, the commissioned Russian nuclear missile submarine was harbored in Magadan Harbor, and I got invited by the captain to go for a tour of the submarine. And I can just tell you, I can't even explain to you how compact, if you've never been in a submarine, a real submarine, you can hardly move anywhere. There's no space, and you're always bumping somebody or something. But anyway, we went toured through the submarine. I saw the vertical where the missiles were, and the officers invited us to have mess in the officers' mess, which is about just twice the size of this table, maybe. Submarines are so cramped. But anyway, we sat down, and he pointed out a picture on the wall where something had hung there, and he said, this was the targets. He said that if we ever got the thing, this is where we'd shoot our missiles to the United States. And I sat there kind of dumbfounded and thought to myself, you know, what is going on here? This people sat around the same table talking about how to destroy us, and here they are trying to become a friend, you know, and that's what we had to come up with. But this Russian captain said they no longer had nuclear warheads on their missiles, and their job was to assist the U.S. Navy in keeping peace in the Pacific. Now, this is 1992. That's what it was like then. It's changed, of course, now. But that was the opportunity we had that our government, and I'll just take a little more history. When we won the Second World War from Japan and Germany, the United States government did everything they could to help Germany and help Japan. You had MacArthur in Japan and the Marshall Plan in Germany. When we defeated the Soviets in the Cold War, which we did, we called them a second-rate nation, our country did. So we missed that opportunity, and we didn't learn that how we learned did it from the Second World War to make it better. I think it would have been a big change if we would have helped out. Of course, if Gorbachev would have stayed, I think we'd have gone very easily, and with the coup and what all happened, it just happened. But it could still happen again. We'll get a chance to make it work right.
Other questions from the audience?
Hi. I'm a high schooler from Eagle River High School, and this is a question for the female on the board. So what is it like living in Alaska now, and what are some of your favorite things to do here?
Because I have been living here for almost 26 years. The first when I moved, it was similar climate. I used to ski. I used to go hiking. Now my favorite things is to explore Alaska during the summertime with my RV. With my RV. I like to travel. And I travel to all different parts that I do not know. And now, because of being part of the Russian Immersion Program, probably my big thing is to do many activities with my students, to do cultural activities. And in 12th grade, we do special curriculum. It's Russia-Alaska relationships. We talk about Russian America. We talk about Russia and Alaska during the Second World War. And we do take educational trips to Ninilchik, Nikolaevsk, to see all of this. I think I still love to explore Alaska from an education point of view now. This is what I do. And spend time with my grandson.
Do we have one more question?
And that probably be the last one.
Yeah, just in the context of today, I'm wondering if any of these relationship kind of channels are still open between Far Eastern Russia and Alaska. And if not, or if so, do you think changes in technology are hindering or improving those opportunities?
Dave, you want to take a shot at that? Maybe speak to business opportunities? Are you aware of any joint ventures going on anymore?
I'm not aware of anything new that's going on. And I think it would be very difficult to do what I did because I went over there and said, what can I buy for you? This time that wouldn't work. I do think if somebody had a product to sell in Russia, like we have oil field services here, I think, that might be able to be sold to Russia, but you would have to find a good Russian partner to walk through, but I think it could be done.
I think it's pretty challenging these days because of lack of transportation. When Alaska Airlines was operating, they flew to all the major population centers in the Far East for about 5 years. But now if you want to go to the Russian Far East, there are two ways to do it. You go to Nome and charter over on Bering Air, which is quite expensive. They only operate in the summertime, I believe. There's a Russian carrier that operates for about 6 weeks in the summer that primarily caters to sport fishing folks. Or you go around the world. You fly from here to Moscow and then come in the back door. So, and then, as I mentioned earlier, the Putin government just does not make it easy to operate in Russia these days, so it's quite challenging.
Elena, I think the biggest difference for me, when I used to send faxes or send a letter that took 30 days to get to Chukotka, is Facebook. I'm on Facebook, and I also Twitter a lot. And so I'm always amazed the number of Facebook friends in Chukotka, Anadyr. And so social media has played an enormous role. And Facebook has an automatic translation. So people can write in Russian and then translate right away. So it's been a big difference.
Okay. Go ahead.
One thing I need to mention that I think we still have, with at least the Russian Far East, the relationship between different churches that exist in Anchorage and in Alaska. They do connect with Vladivostok, they do connect with Khabarovsk, and the mission that was established by Archbishop Hurley through Catholic services still exists. I mean, that support, that kind of channel still exists through the churches, as far as I know. Some of my students participate in that as well.
Spasibo bolshoi to all of our panelists. Thanks so much. Lisa.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been hearing tales from key players in melting the Alaska-Russia ice curtain in the mid-1980s as they discussed how Alaska helped end the Cold War, launching a 30-year era of productive commercial and personal relationships across the Bering Strait. If you missed a portion of the show, you can always go back and listen to it again by visiting the Addressing Alaskans page at alaskapublic.org, or you can search for the Addressing Alaskans podcast in your favorite podcast app. I'm your host and producer for Addressing Alaskans, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.